Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, we talk about sarcoidosis.
It can get into the lung substance and in the airways of the lung, and that leads to loss of lung function.
Plus, an all-too-common problem and how to prevent it from happening to you, kidney stones.
I think the most important thing is you've got to drink water. Any non-alcoholic beverage outside of maybe dark colas and the high fructose containing juices.
And concussions in sports, things you and your student athlete should know.
If we recognize a concussion, if we treat the person properly, in almost all cases, we can prevent some of the long-term problems that you may be hearing about.
We'll also get a checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore that annoying and often painful medical problem called kidney stones and how to prevent them. Plus, we'll revisit the recurring problem of sports-related concussions and how you can avoid them. But first, we examine a little-known disease called sarcoidosis and what can be done about it. It's estimated that up to 4 in 10,000 people in the U.S. have sarcoidosis, an inflammatory disease that affects multiple organs in the body, but mostly the lungs and lymph glands. It can vary in its intensity from mild to severe, and in some cases can even lead to death. Well, here to tell us more about this disease and what can be done to treat it is Dr. Michael Iannuzzi. He's professor and chair of medicine at Upstate Medical University, specializing in pulmonary medicine. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So help us understand. Let's begin by helping us understand what exactly is sarcoidosis.
So as you said so well, it is an inflammatory disease, and the inflammation can occur in just about any organ in the body, as you mentioned, and it involves the lungs in over 90% of patients who have the disease. We don't know what starts the inflammation, what initiates the problem, and the inflammation is a particular kind of inflammation which we call granulomas. Now,
what does that exactly mean?
So to get you a picture in your mind, if you just imagine a water bowl on the floor and a dozen puppies all around that water bowl trying to get to it. Granulomas are the white cells in the body, specifically the lymphocytes and what we call macrophages, around a potential pathogen trying to eat it. And just as these puppies are trying to squeeze their way in and circling around the water bowl, the macrophages and lymphocytes are circling around some yet-to-be-identified pathogen, and these cascading circular cell buildup that form these granulomas.
Are they little masses then?
They're little masses of cells, and these little masses of cells then wreak their havoc by being there and interfering with the normal architecture of the organ, and then in interfering with its architecture can, in some cases, interfere with its function.
So in other words, this is something with the immune system gone awry.
Yes, it is an immune disorder. It is a what we call a hypersensitivity type of reaction where the immune system is turned on to a greater extent than it should be.
And as a result, these granulomas form. They get in the way of the functioning, both physically and potentially functionally, of a particular organ.
Yes.
And in the case of the lungs, what do they do?
So in the lungs, they build up, these granulomas build up in the lymph nodes, which result in no significant problem nearly all the time that they do occur. But it can get into the lung substance and in the airways of the lung, and that leads to loss of lung function.
Okay. What are the symptoms when we were talking about? Obviously, it depends on where you find them, but what kinds of symptoms can you expect to have?
Fatigue, sweating, weight loss, chest discomfort, shortness of breath, cough, joint aches, skin rashes. Those are the predominant symptoms.
It sounds like it's almost anything. It's pretty wide-ranging.
Yes, and I should point out that a large percentage of patients may have no symptoms, and the disease is detected when a chest X-ray is obtained for some other reason, screening physical exam, or for some other complaints, and the enlarged lymph nodes or abnormalities in the lung itself are detected.
So there's a really a great variability, even in terms of how the symptoms show themselves over time.
Yes, and that's what makes it confusing to many physicians and healthcare providers who face patients with these nonspecific symptoms and often don't think about sarcoidosis when the patient presents with these with these symptoms that are difficult to pinpoint any one disease.
And sometimes they can begin suddenly or severely and then go away, and then they can come back. So that also must be very befuddling
to
the healthcare provider.
Yes, it can be an acute form, which can also involve vision, blurry vision, photophobia, the light hurting the eyes, as well as a skin rash and joint aches. Or it can be very insidious, not feeling well for months.
Yeah, that would be very difficult, I would think, to diagnose. And maybe people would be prone to thinking, well, it's all in my head, or I just have a kind of a little cold and it'll go away kind of thing.
Yes.
So do we know what causes it?
We don't know what causes it. We suspect that it's something in the air, something we breathe in. And the reason we suspect it's something in the air is because more than 90% of patients have lung involvement, so we breathe in the air.
So that would be the first site in many cases.
In many cases, but also the other common sites are the eyes and the skin, which are both always
exposed to the air.
So because of that pattern of organ involvement, we suspect it's an airborne
pathogen. But we really have no clue at this point as to what it is.
No, it happens all over the world. It happens in all climates. And for that reason, it's escaped us what the cause is.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Michael Iannuzzi, and we're talking about sarcoidosis. Well, who's most at risk for this disease?
Young women, their 20 to 40s, are the highest, and African-American women have the highest risk for sarcoidosis, but it clearly can involve anyone at any age.
Do we think that because you mentioned the African-Americans have a higher rate, that there's some genetic predisposition to developing it?
Yes, we do, and we know that African-Americans more commonly have relatives, siblings and cousins, parents and children with sarcoidosis. So that led us to think more about this being a genetic predisposition to whatever is out there that we're all exposed to. In a lot of ways, it's a lot like, say, hay fever. We're all exposed to pollen, but not all of us react to it.
How is the disease diagnosed currently? I mean, how do you know? Because what I think I'm hearing from everything you're saying, it's almost like a mystery disease. It's almost, it can be mistaken for any number of other diseases, and it can come and go, and you don't even know you've had it.
There's three components to making the diagnosis: the clinical presentation, the signs and symptoms that the patient presents with, radiographic features, the imaging that shows a collection of these granulomas resulting in alteration of the way an organ looks on radiology,
And then you might have, excuse me for interrupting, so you might have something in the lung, in a chest x-ray that shows some kind of pulmonary infiltrates or something in the lungs, or in the lymph nodes, some change.
That's the characteristic feature, is the chest x-ray abnormality. And then the third is by histologic confirmation or biopsying an affected organ and seeing these granulomas under the microscope.
So that's definitive. I mean,
that is what's required to make the diagnosis.
What do you do to treat it?
So,
and how often is it necessary to treat?
About a third of patients who have sarcoidosis, the disease comes and goes on its own, and within 1 or 2 years, often doesn't require more than an aspirin-like medication for joint aches or discomforts. A third of patients, the disease can come and last for 5-7 years and then require some anti-inflammatory medication, such as steroids, prednisone. And then there's alternative drugs that we use to help minimize the use of steroids. And there are several different types of drugs, including intravenous medication, that we can try to modulate the immune system. And a third of patients, the disease can progress, and our therapy may not be as effective in those patients.
How does your health play a role? In other words, are there other things that are, just in terms of good health practices, can help you fight this kind of disease or do better if you have it?
There are several things. One is to be in the best physical shape one could be in with exercise and diet. Having good exercise and keeping the respiratory system in as good a shape, the cardiovascular system and the respiratory system in as good a shape as possible, helps mitigate the symptoms of shortness of breath on exertion or shortness of breath, to keep one's weight at the ideal body weight, and to have a good sleep pattern. And
so generally all the things that you would want to do to maintain good health. And how about smoking? Smoking, it seems to me,
smoking is absolutely forbidden.
Yeah, that would make real problems in the lungs.
It definitely adds fuel to the fire.
So what generally do you see in your practice in terms of the natural history of this kind of disease and the types of people that you treat?
Well, we see the whole spectrum of the disease, from patients in whom the disease was just detected on a chest x-ray and are asymptomatic and don't require much other than occasional monitoring, to people with severe involvement resulting in respiratory failure or cardiac failure, or even involving the neurologic system. So we see at Upstate the full gamut of patients. Perhaps because we're more of a referral center, we see the patients who are more severe.
But it can have lasting complications if it's untreated or if it's undiagnosed. Is that correct? So if you think you, I guess, what's the takeaway here?
The takeaway is for patients and their physicians to consider the disease when they present with these symptoms and signs, and to consider referring for further evaluation to clarify the diagnosis.
Yeah, it sounds to me like there are so many organ systems that could be affected, and you could have long-lasting problems with the lungs. I read somewhere that you could even have blindness with the eyes if it's untreated, heart problems, kidney problems, as you said, central nervous system problems. And because it masks itself, or it's somewhat unclear as to what it is, unless it's diagnosed, you really could, if left untreated, you could really end up in trouble.
Yes, and many patients tell us that they have been bouncing around for months before the correct diagnosis was arrived at.
Well, thanks so much for coming in with all this very interesting and important information. My guest has been Dr. Michael Iannuzzi. He's professor and chair of medicine at Upstate Medical University, specializing in pulmonary medicine. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, preventing those annoying and painful kidney stones. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen along with you. Kidney stones, they affect almost 4 million people in the United States each year, and the number of cases is on the rise both here and across the globe. But the causes for this rise remain unclear. Despite their cause, they can be a quite debilitating and very painful problem. We'll hear with more on this and what you can do to prevent their formation is Dr. Stephen Knoll. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and the Residency Program Director and Vice Chair for Education at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Knoll. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
So kidney stones are on the rise. Help us understand, though, what exactly are they?
Kidney stones are best way to describe it is think of like table salt, okay? And you can have these salts, so it can be sodium chloride like table salt or other salts like calcium oxalate that literally become solid in the kidneys and form what are called kidney stones.
So they're like little balls or little calcifications or...
Well, I would say the best way to describe it is really that they are things that are in liquid that become then solid. They may look like a ball, but they can be of various shapes and sizes.
And different sizes, like from the like for a grain of sand to a golf ball.
Absolutely.
Right. So they form, repeat that again, remind me, they form in the kidney.
They form in the kidney, in the urine.
So why do they create so much pain?
Well, when you get a stone, and the stone is then trying to pass, your pipe that connects the kidney to the bladder, called the ureter, It moves the urine through what we call peristalsis. It's sort of a combination of the nerve cells and the muscle cells to help move that urine through. And when you have a blockage, for example, from a kidney stone, you're going to get more of this peristalsis, and that creates a tremendous amount of pain. So it's not really the stone itself that's causing the pain. It's the response to the stone that's causing the pain.
Little contractions.
Yeah.
Almost, exactly I hate to draw this analogy, and maybe this is not the same, but like in childbirth, you're having those continuous contractions
maybe something similar.
The uterus. And so this is on the ureter
is
getting contracted, so it's a lot of pain.
That's right.
Do we have a clue as to why they're on the rise?
There are probably a number of factors. Certainly, if we look at the obesity epidemic, there's definitely been a rise in stones that seems to be very much related to the rise in weight. The increase in diabetes, which again may also be tied to the obesity epidemic, certainly there's a link between diabetes and stones. There's some discussion about whether or not temperature change across the globe may have some role. Certainly, if we're talking about things coming out to make stones, the best way to prevent is to keep them in the solution, and the best way is by more water. And if there's much higher temperatures, you may sweat more, which means less water to the kidneys.
So obesity and is diet, does diet play a role? For example, what you eat?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Whether or not that's directly tied to an increase is not entirely clear, because our diet has not been a tremendously healthy diet for decades. Although with the use of high fructose corn syrup, which sort of began maybe in the late 80s, again, there seems to be an increase in stones, but is it the high fructose corn syrup or is it the obesity that's resulted from the high fructose corn syrup is not entirely clear.
So why should weight or obesity add to the stone formation? I don't get quite that association.
It's not entirely been elucidated, but there's certainly very good data that the heavier you are, for example, or if you have diabetes, it alters the chemistry of the kidney and the way it handles certain substances, and it predisposes to easier stone formation.
That's interesting. So what happens is somehow that there's this concentration of these of the stone, and it kind of gloms together and makes, you know, the salts become kind of hardened. And is it purely, you said if there's more water, then the likelihood is less that the stones will form. Yep. So it's just really almost it's a concentration or a
that's exactly
it's the concentration of salt within a liquid.
Yeah, take a beaker and put some salt, Morton salt, in there, and then how do you dissolve it? You dissolve it by putting in water. And if you have enough water in there, it's not going to come back out to the salt anymore. It just stays dissolved in the solution.
So you also alluded to the higher global temperatures,
yeah.
And that's certainly been talked about with global warming.
Sure.
So you think worldwide with higher temperatures, therefore, as you said, people will sweat more, have less water within their bodies, and then potentially that's playing a role as well?
Well, that's certainly it's certainly a possibility. There's no absolute proof of that happening, just like there's a lot of debate about global warming. But certainly, we know in this country, for example, we have what we call the Stone Belt, which is in the southwest and southeastern United States. Their temperatures are higher than, for example, our climate here in Syracuse. And the prevalence is much higher in those areas.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah. That really would point to it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Stephen Knoll, and we're talking about kidney stones, what causes them, and then how to avoid them. So who's most at risk for stones?
If you look at the data, it appears that the young Caucasian male, generally the ages would be somewhere between 30 and 60 years old. Next would be Latino, followed by African American. Men do seem to outnumber women, although that gap is closing. It's not entirely clear why that's the case, although it is believed that obesity is playing a role there as well.
So once you get a kidney stone, are you more at risk for it recurring?
Absolutely. You're talking about your lifetime risk of having a second stone. That's probably about the flip of a coin. So you're
talking
about 50%.
So there's something that happens within your body, or maybe whatever factors cause the first stone, unless you change them, will cause successive stones.
Most stones you can probably, you could probably safely say are the result of some genetic predisposition that then with environmental changes is what leads to the stone, which means you're going to be at risk for future stones unless you modify the environment, since we really don't have the ability to modify the genetic predisposition.
Right. So does it tend to run in families?
Absolutely.
So you do see that strong genetic link there. Given the relationship to this higher temperatures outside that we were talking about and the fact that you might sweat more, is it more prevalent? Are they more prevalent in the summer months?
There seems to be a tick up in stones in the summer months. And in certain areas, there may be a tick up in the holiday season, not because of temperature, but because of dietary changes.
Like what?
So calcium oxalate stones are the most common stones in the world. You can oftentimes see a tick in the prevalence of that type of stone. For example, like maybe around Christmas in the Northeast, the use of strawberry rhubarb pie, Thanksgiving and Christmas time.
Really?
And strawberries and rhubarb are very, very high sources of oxalate. And so if you're not drinking as much, maybe because you're consuming a little more alcohol, you may be predisposing yourself to stones.
That's very interesting. So diet really plays a huge role.
Yep.
I mean, what you put into your body, as well as perhaps your genetic predisposition,
yep.
But what you put into your body is really crucial here.
Absolutely.
In terms of the predisposition to it and perhaps controlling it.
Yep.
So to help us understand then, with all this in mind, mm-hmm. how can you avoid getting them? And we'll talk about then how to cope with them. What do you recommend people do to avoid getting them?
I think the most important thing, and if the only thing they remember from our interview today is what I'm about to say, then we did a great job, is you've got to drink. And water is ideal, but
honestly, you've got to drink, people might think of that as
alcohol. Yeah, so step back, not alcohol. So water, any non-alcoholic beverage outside of maybe dark colas and the high fructose containing juices like the Kool-Aids, anything else is probably fine. Water is ideal. Lemon, so squeezing lemon into the water because it contains a substance that can inhibit stones called citrate. Your goal is to be drinking essentially an 8-ounce cup every hour you're awake. That's the goal if you've had stones to prevent further stones. And that is really the most important thing you can do.
More important
than any medications or any other dietary changes.
When you say you were mentioning lemons, would other citrus fruit play a similar role?
Some
like
citrus
limes
fruits,
or oranges
lime
or
doesn't
grapes?
Seem to have as much of an effect, but oranges certainly yes, but they also have a higher content of oxalate, so you have to be somewhat mindful.
So lemon water basically is ideal, is Absolutely. What you're saying. And how about diet? What should you be avoiding as far as food? In other words, is a diet higher in animal protein maybe more likely to cause stones?
Yep. So you'd want to, if you can, you'd at the very least, don't add salt to your foods. That's very important. If you can limit your salt intake, that will reduce your risk. Animal proteins are tied to calcium stones as well as uric acid stones. So if you can limit your intake of animal protein. And then if, depending on the type of stone you have, then it's important to, you know, see someone perhaps like myself who can then talk about what other measures are necessary.
How about salt? Do you have to cut back on salt?
Absolutely.
And how about weight? Is that an important factor? You were mentioning obesity. Should you be looking to lose weight as a potential preventative
measure?
Right,
so weight is an important factor, but there haven't been any studies that have directly assessed weight loss and incidence of stone, so I can't answer that question.
How about calcium supplements?
So calcium, you should not restrict your calcium by any means, and however you need to get your calcium is probably fine, but you don't want to overdo it. So either through diet or through supplementation, it would be fine as long as you're not going overboard.
Well, that's really helpful. In the very little time we have left, what do you do if you have kidney stones? What's your recommendation?
If you have an attack, generally because it's so painful, you're going to wind up in an urgent care or an emergency setting, and then you may wind up seeing a urology doctor who then may have you see someone like myself to try to institute measures for prevention in the future.
So the key is obviously once you've had a kidney stone, you really are at greater risk to have it again, and you need to take a look at your diet, exercise, weight, and all of those things, and hydration, crucially, as the thing.
Yep.
Well, thanks so much. This is very, very helpful information and very, very important information. Any last thought? Hydration is the key.
That's the key, hydration.
Well, thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Knoll. He's Associate Professor of Medicine, Residency Program Director, and he's the Vice Chair for Education at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Slip, fall, crack, pain, addict, or an excruciating, illuminating moment? Well, folks, I was being healthy good, out running on a cold winter's day, saw a car backing down a hill still covered in snow, thought, this hill must be slippery, stopped. Saw the asphalt peeking through, so reckoned it was okay. Slid my feet very carefully, and then backwards, boom, heard a crunch. Not with my ears, but from inside my body, and knew I'd cracked a rib. Now, I didn't know much about pain before. Whenever I yawned, burped, breathed deep, laughed, raised my arm on that side, turned my body, sat, stood, sneezed, the pain was, let's just say, excruciating is a vast understatement. In the ER, the doc told me it would be 3 weeks to 3 months before I was pain-free and prescribed oxycodone, an opioid painkiller. It worked. Some took the pain from an initially constant 7 out of 10 to a 4 or 5. But then waking midnight to pee, my good arm stuck under me on the couch, my wife asleep upstairs, I had no choice but to use my painful side arm. Whoa. 10 minutes of whimpering, pleading, oh my, please stop. Breathtaking agony to turn my body. A despairing depth of pain I just didn't know existed. I knew then how easy it is to get addicted. I was moments from taking another oxycodone, even though I wasn't due for another 2 hours. I didn't because I remembered the research showing that in a few days, opioids make the brain more sensitive to pain. and don't help in the long run beyond just those few couple of weeks maybe. But all the same, 50% of those taking opioids for 30 days are still on them 5 years later, addicted. And I didn't because I realized that a good part of what made that agony so awful was my terrifying thoughts that it would just keep happening and I would have no control, no options, and that oxycodone was the best there is. Then I stopped the opioids completely after I found they made me white-knuckle, cursing, tearfully constipated. No kidding. I stopped after I undid my terrifying thoughts about the future by taking control now and sleeping in the recliner and switching to an over-the-counter painkiller, which, surprise, was almost as helpful, and let my gut get moving again. Options. So, my friends, my personal lessons on dealing with pain, obviously prevention is best. Take good care so you don't develop chronic pain. If you do, know that opioids aren't magic. May help briefly, but with costs and a big risk of addiction. And the research shows there are many other ways to reduce pain. Physical activity often helps with back pain, headaches, osteoarthritis, fibromyalgia, as do physical therapy, meditation, acupuncture, massage, yoga, tai chi, relaxation techniques, and cognitive behavioral therapy to manage those terrifying thoughts. Of course, see your physician to get the right diagnosis and treatment plan. And don't forget Grandma's remedy of prunes. Yeah, I'm Dr. Rich, feeling a whole lot better, thanks, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, sports-related concussions can be serious. What do you need to know? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of February 1st. Revive your routine. Having a consistent fitness routine is the easiest way to make activity part of your daily life. When planning your exercise, aim for SMART moves. SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely moves. Pick a time and place and activity that fits into your life and stick with it. This week, find three places in your schedule where you can fit your fitness. It may be in the morning, during your lunch break, before dinner, or in the evening. Recommit to these at the end of the week or adjust your workout schedule if need be. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Concussions and the potential for subsequent brain injury is on the mind of many parents today, especially with the start of school year and fall sports. There's been much attention to the hundreds of thousands of sports-related concussions in this country, ranging from the high-profile NFL players with traumatic brain injury to fears of what these repeated head injuries might be doing to our children while they engage in sports like football and soccer. And here with more on this is Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of the Upstate Concussion Center. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Linda. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's always wonderful to see you. So this continues to be of great concern, so much so that all 50 states now have sports concussion laws, including New York. Explain that to us. Tell us about that.
Well, certainly over the last several years, there's been a lot of attention paid to sports concussion, and I think there's been a recognition that with the prevalence of this condition, there needed to be more work done to make sure that we protected our kids. And the real focus has been on educating people about what the right way to manage a concussion is. Because If we do that properly, if we recognize a concussion, if we treat the person properly, in almost all cases, we can prevent some of the long-term problems that you may be hearing about.
Isn't it really important, because it's the proper management of concussion, as you said, could really reduce the duration and the severity of the symptoms going forward?
I think that's the belief of many people who work in this field of concussion and have seen the cases where an athlete was either hiding symptoms or was not managed properly, and it seems that there's an increased risk in those cases of more prolonged and severe symptoms affecting their schoolwork or their ability to participate in sports, et cetera.
So just help us understand very briefly what the guidelines are, particularly in New York State.
Right, and they're pretty simple and pretty consistent across the states, which is that in the event of a suspected concussion, it's imperative that an athlete immediately be removed from the practice or game, and in fact be removed from any activity where there could be an increased risk of head injury. And it's a pretty simple idea. When the brain is hurt, it's more vulnerable to being hurt again. So we want to wait until it's recovered before we allow that person to go back to risky activities.
So is there a prescribed time frame in terms of how long someone has to be taken out of these activities? And are there other activities, that ancillary activities, such as schoolwork or things that require mentation or heavy thinking, that would also be prohibited or limited?
Yes. The first step is, if someone on the sidelines, and there's not always a medical person on the sidelines, but let's say a coach or someone is suspicious, they pull that person out. The first step is get that medical evaluation. And maybe there's not a diagnosis of concussion and it's safe for the person to go back. But if there is a diagnosis of concussion, then that kicks in a pretty standard protocol where we're going to keep an eye on that athlete. We usually expect that the symptoms can worsen in the first few days, so we really want to pay attention. There's a growing sense that maybe we should keep these kids out of school for a day or two automatically just to really let them rest. We don't want to have them be out of school too long, certainly no longer than necessary, but perhaps resting that brain aggressively early on helps. Then we're going to wait till the symptoms have resolved or gone away while they're resting, and then we gradually introduce them back to physical and mental activity. If the symptoms don't come back during that period, that's when it's safe for them to go back.
Why is it so hard for it to be diagnosed? I remember you told in an earlier interview I had with you that concussions so often can be missed because it's hard to diagnose. Help us understand that.
This is a huge frustration to those of us working in the area of concussion. We have no medical test that diagnoses a concussion. It still relies on signs and symptoms. So we see a person gets hit, we see a person's in a car accident or whatever happens, and we really are just taking a good history, listening to what they describe about how they feel, and then making a determination that the person has had a concussion or not. But the symptoms are not specific to a concussion, so that can be a difficult call to make sometimes.
So that things like CT scans, which we often rely on for so many other types of things, really doesn't show a concussion.
That's an excellent point. The reason that CT scans are done is to determine whether the injury is more severe than a concussion, whether there's bleeding or swelling or a skull fracture that would warrant neurosurgical intervention. But in the vast majority of cases, a CT scan is normal. And as a matter of fact, there's a growing effort to try to reduce the use of CT scan, especially in children, because of the amount of radiation that's involved in those scans. So if you're a parent out there and your kid has a concussion and they go to the emergency room, oftentimes you want that CT scan done to reassure you, but the doctors may be telling you that we don't think it's needed, and actually it's probably better for your child if we don't do it. So be prepared that you may hear that now.
I could see why parents would be alarmed at that on both sides of the discussion.
Yes.
There are also some myths around concussion, the idea that you need to have blacked out in order for you to have sustained a concussion, or that everyone gets better within a two-week period, or once the headache leaves, all is well. So it seems like people need to, especially the people around kids in sports, need to understand very clearly what these symptoms are and what they mean.
Yes, and that's a good point. So only 10% of athletes actually lose consciousness. So yes, definitely most do not. And there have been some studies. I just did a talk for some soccer parents, and one of the studies I found preparing for that showed that soccer athletes, high school soccer players who had some education about concussion were twice as likely to report their symptoms to their coach as those who didn't have education. So there's a lot we don't understand and don't know about concussion, but we do know that if we give people the right education, we have a better chance of recognizing those injuries and of working together to manage them properly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Brian Rieger, and we're talking about concussion and what's being done to diminish the hazardous effects of it. I mean, one of the things you told me many times we've talked is the fact that many kids don't recognize that they've had a concussion, even kids and even coaches, and that leads to the problem. And it's not limited just to the classic high school football players, that it's permeating all through sports today. Tell us about that.
Yes, you know, the symptoms of a concussion can be quite varied. Everything from headache, which is the most common symptom, to vision problems. My daughter plays soccer, and a player on her team was telling her that she saw circles in her eyes after she got hit on the head. That was one of the symptoms that she had. And that's not necessarily something that a high school person might know could possibly be a symptom of concussion. So, again, I think while it can be difficult sometimes to sort it out, there is a pretty typical set of symptoms that everybody should have some awareness about.
But more and more kids are being exposed as we play. You know, you have youth soccer now. I mean, it's not limited to just that high school football player on the defensive line back. I mean, you know, we need to look across the board. Wasn't there some interesting statistics recently that suggested that now more soccer is contributing as much?
Well, high school football and girls soccer together contribute to more concussions at the high school age than other sports. So most of the concussions come from those sports.
And that's the most recent data we have.
Yes, yes. And that's probably because of the popularity of those sports amongst boys and girls, but also the risk. But again, my daughter plays soccer. I was just at a game last night, so I'm not, suggesting that we need to not play sports. Quite the contrary. I think sports have a lot of value, but especially in youth sports. So we have these laws, but these laws apply primarily to scholastic sports. In youth sports, there are still very little guidelines, very little mandated education.
So when you say youth sports, you're talking about sports that take place outside
correct.
Of the aegis of a school.
Correct.
And they could be something like Little League, for
correct.
Example?
Correct, Little League or Pop Warner football, or in this area, certainly youth lacrosse leagues, youth soccer leagues. Exactly.
So parents really need to be aware of this and, you know, basically prepare their coaches, insist that their coaches really, or someone, a trainer or someone, really is apprised of the significance of potential concussion.
Yes, I mean, in youth sports, there's rarely a medical professional like a trainer.
So what exactly happens to the brain once there's been a concussion? What I mean is, I'm not asking you for, you know, data in terms of what's actually physiologically happening, but in terms of what are the effects on a brain that where maybe it's not being recognized? What are the short-term effects, mm-hmm. and then what are the longer-term effects?
So a concussion's a brain injury caused by a blow or a jolt to the head, and there's multiple ways that the brain is affected. The neurochemistry of the brain is affected, the blood supply to the brain can be affected, and the microstructural architecture of the brain, the actual fibers of the brain, can be affected. And in most cases, this is a transient effect that resolves within about a week or two in the vast majority of cases. But we have so much more sensitive ways of looking at the brain now that we're really beginning to understand how complicated these injuries can be, and also how it's possible that the brain can be affected even when the hit to the head doesn't actually produce a concussion.
We really?
Call these subconcussive events. And there's a lot of interest now, not only in concussion, but what might be the effects of accumulated trauma to the brain. So let's say you play a season of football and you take multiple hits to the head, but you don't actually suffer a concussion. Is there some risk associated with that? There have been studies with professional football players in particular that have raised concerns about the effects of repeated head trauma.
leading to things long-term like dementia, ALS, Parkinson's, that kind of thing.
Yes, all of those have been suggested. It's certainly too early to know exactly what those relationships are, but I certainly think that we have enough information to know that we need to do more research into this area, and a lot is beginning to happen there.
How about kids in school who've had, let's say, played a season of football or play a season of soccer and may or may not sustain some, like you said, having more of these subconcussive events? Are we likely to see issues with learning problems, impulse control, that kind of thing? What's been your experience?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think in the cases where we don't actually meet the threshold for a concussion, I think in a younger child, we're still a ways from being able to say that that's going to produce these problems. Parents may certainly worry about that. They may attribute changes in their child to some of these things. But I think right now, I think we're more concerned about people who take repeated hits over a sustained career than at this point we are, say, one season of high school sports. But we do know that the developing brain, such as in high school, may be more vulnerable. So I'm just going to keep saying that it's a little too early to answer that question. There's a lot of people concerned about it. But right now, we certainly aren't able to draw that connection.
So bottom line, what's the takeaway?
I think the most important thing is that if we properly recognize and manage concussion, and if we do what we can do to help prevent concussion, proper education about avoiding dangerous play, about educating coaches and athletes what the symptoms are, I think in most cases we're going to get through this without problems. And certainly if there are questions, call our clinic and we'll...
Yeah, very briefly, in the very little bit of time we have left, what does your clinic offer?
So at the Upstate Concussion Center, we offer education and treatment, and we are also involved in some research about concussions. So certainly we treat people. We tend to see complicated cases where there have been multiple concussions. We often have parents coming in with that question, should I let my child go back to play this sport? And there aren't clear answers always, but we try to educate people and help them make an informed decision. And when needed, we have a multidisciplinary team that offers comprehensive treatment for those complicated cases.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for coming in. As always, it's a pleasure to hear you, talk to you, and learn all that you have to offer. My guest has been Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of the Upstate Concussion Center. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. There's nothing like a good mystery story to hold our attention. Medical student Julian Grace Abad won the writing award here at Upstate last year for her story, Valerie's Secret. Here is an excerpt. Valerie's father told her, once she was old enough to understand the difference between secrets and lies, that between the two, secrets are the greater evil. The way he explained it at the time didn't make sense, but he was her father, so she took his word for it. And when he slid her off his knee, bent down, and offered her his crooked little finger, she reached up and gave him her own without a second thought. "No secrets," she said. Her father laughed deep in his throat. "Promise?" he said. "Promise," Valerie murmured and clenched the steering wheel to still her hands. "What was that?" said her father. He squinted at the temperature controls, his glasses halfway down his nose. Valerie batted his hand away and turned the heat up. "Nothing," she said. A hazy green light bled through the fog. Valerie lurched forward, veered right, and swung onto the interstate, while her father smiled at the lights of the medical school and the hospital, watching them fade into the frigid sky. Valerie coughed, harder than she had the night before, but not from the dust that floated through the air and settled snow-like on the leatherette seats. "How's school?" said her father absently. "Lots of work, not enough sleep. We're done with gross anatomy, thank goodness. Couldn't wait for that to be over." "That bad, huh?" said her father. "Why, was it too gross for you?" As he chuckled at his terrible joke, Valerie found herself smiling. She could never get tired of her father's laugh. Quick, easy, earthy, like he meant it every time. When he laughed, Valerie could almost pretend that everything was all right. Almost. He looked even smarter than last time. Crisp shirt tucked neatly into well-ironed slacks, smooth leather shoes, polished and gleaming like mirrors. He wasn't dressing up for her, was he? Of course I am, he always said. I'm going to be the father of a doctor, so I should look the part. But Valerie knew he was just getting old and a bit insecure. He didn't have to worry, though. His hair hadn't changed color yet, just a few specks of gray around the ears, like salt scattered on asphalt. Well, Valerie had a story for her father this Thanksgiving, one that was sure to turn his hair the wrong shade of white. She'd kept this story to herself for 3 months already, gotten a second, third opinion, had more scans and tests than she wanted to remember. And every day, as she kept on waiting and working and waiting some more, she got just a little bit weaker and just a little bit closer to the end of her story. 5 years wasn't a long time if you thought about it. She'd have to tell her father before the end of day. Valerie knew that. Even if she wanted to keep her secret, he'd notice the darkness under her eyes, the weight she'd lost, the cough that wouldn't go away. He'd ask. She'd tell him. And when she was finished, he wouldn't be laughing.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine some local efforts to destigmatize mental illness. Plus, we'll take a closer look at hypertension and how to control it. And how to deal with that annoying but sometimes frightening nosebleed. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's called HealthLink on Air, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or you can check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel. It's produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.